This is Peace Talks Radio, the nonpartisan, nonpolitical series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution that focuses primarily on the search for inner peace and learning how we can interact with each other to reduce conflict, one-on-one or in groups. We also spotlight the work of peacemakers from throughout history and those doing the good work today. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we'll meet Paul Ray, an artist, philosopher, and creator of a special Peace Prize to celebrate the peace work of others. First, though, a conversation with a religious scholar and author who's been studying the commonalities between diverse religious traditions for years. It's Will Keepin, who in 2016 published the book Belonging to God, Science, Spirituality, and a Universal Path of Divine Love.
We all know it's very important now to bridge the religions because, as Hans Kung said beautifully, he said, there will be no peace between nations without peace between religions. Mm. And so there is so much misunderstanding today about what the religions actually stand for. Part of the reason I wrote this book was to articulate that there is a universal path of love and peace across the religious traditions. And to really articulate that, because if that's true, then all of the religions are actually vehicles for peacemaking. The second thing I want to say is that the religious transformation, or this what we might broaden into the spiritual transformation that takes place within the religious traditions, is, in my view, a strong pre and co-requisite for becoming a peacemaker. Actually, Martin Luther King gave a beautiful outline. He said that if you want to, you know, be a peacemaker in an area of conflict, he said there are four steps. The first step is to sort of document the injustice. And the second step is to then go to the party with whom you have the grievance and present it. Now, assuming that they don't respond in the way that you'd like, before you move in direct action, which is, you know, what he did was kind of civil disobedience type of action, and you begin sort of mounting an offensive to challenge the opponent, there was an intermediate step that he called the inner work or the purification. This is the part that religious practices are intended to do, where we transform our egoic ambitions and empty ourselves of sort of our personal agendas, and we thereby become a more effective instrument for peace.
That takes a lot of work, very conscious work. Yeah, and it's interesting too. In mentioning King, is that one thing that he was really committed to was a deep understanding of his obstacle or his opponent. He would spend a lot of time in one of his routine talks to people, going into a deep explanation, and he would say, "Now stay with me on this. You know, here's why poor whites are so angry with blacks." So this suggests that there is a studious place one can go to serve peacemaking.
Thank you, Paul. That's very beautifully spoken. And I think that what we need now is more of that kind of really conscious attempt to learn about our supposed adversaries. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I'll give one example in the case of Islam. We know there's a widespread Islamophobia now. Many people don't realize that the very word Islam actually means to submit or to surrender to God, which is the same teaching that we find in Christianity and Judaism. So the actual fundamental essence of the tradition has the same root. But it's very easily misunderstood because there's a verse in the Quran, for example, that says the only valid religion in the sight of God is self-surrender. But the word for self-surrender, the Arabic word, was Islam. And so that gets translated as an exclusivist, the only religion valid in the sight of God is Islam. So you can see how these things get easily misunderstood and then become the source of contention and conflict.
Right. I was going to ask you about that because you write about how religions define a devotion to God. And I think this does confuse some people, and that fixation on a godlike figure or Jesus in the Christian faith, it's understood in a way that complicates decisions about what to do in life. The idea that God will provide and there's nothing one needs to do but believe that and it will happen. I think most people know someone who lives a life that way and wants to say to them, yes, but you really do have to set aside money for retirement, or you really should get that mole on your face checked out. You know, what do you share in your book that's helpful in this common dilemma around free will and devotion to what you call the ultimate reality?
Well, I appreciate the example you're making, because I've never seen that spirituality should replace common sense, or that you should usurp it. So, for example, I certainly do my doctorate checkups, you know, check out those moles. And, you know, as it's said, I think in the Islamic tradition, you know, trust in Allah, but tie your camel to the post kind of idea. At the same time, what I understand is that, especially when one wants to move into the arena of peacemaking and becoming an instrument for resolving conflict, there are forces and factors that are entirely beyond one person's control and even understanding. And so we have to move into a larger sort of space of the heart, if you will, where we're holding in our own awareness and in our own heart the different contending forces. And then we can strive for some constructive resolution between these contending forces, often starting by looking for common ground, and then looking for the substance of the differences. And if we focus on the common ground, we often find that there's much more common ground than we would have thought.
Right. And you mentioned the kind of current crisis over Islamophobia. So if you had a couple of minutes with a room full of those most fearful and misunderstanding of the Islamic faith in recent years, what would you offer to begin to close that gap of knowledge?
I think I would begin by asking them, how many of you have ever been inspired by the great mystic poet Rumi? Many people now have found the poet of this Islamic poet, Jalaluddin Rumi, very inspiring, and he's probably the most translated poet of divine love, really, ever in history. And so if a number of hands went up, which they do in most of my audiences, then I would explain, you may not be aware of it, but if you love Rumi, you actually already love the sacred wisdom of the Islamic tradition, because everything he wrote and all of his incredible wisdom came directly out of the Quran and the prophetic tradition, the Ahadith, from Islam. And Rumi's very, very clear about that. He says very specifically, if anyone who repudiates the Quran repudiates my teaching, because I am the slave of the Quran while I still have life. I am dust on the path of Muhammad, the chosen one. So that's very interesting for people to realize, that this profoundly inspiring wisdom that moves so many actually comes directly from the tradition that many are very afraid of.
Mm-hmm. There's something about language, though, that really, I think, represent obstacles or speed bumps. Even when you were quoting that and used the word, or the word in scripture that said, slave to the Quran, I think some people flinch at that.
Yes.
And that gets a little bit back to my previous question about the single-minded devotion to God, where a conversation can drift with folks in that category that can't get to the common sense level or something, that it ends pretty quickly with a reference to scripture, or making Jesus Christ my Lord and Savior, or I'm a slave to the Quran.
Yes.
Help us nudge past those objections or concerns.
Well, it's a very subtle issue here, because Teresa of Avila says the same thing at one point to her nuns. She's one of the greatest Christian mystics. And she says, do you know what it really means to be spiritual? She said, it means to be the slave of God. But, you know, she articulates what that means. What that means is that she has so given herself over to, in her case, to Jesus, that she allows Jesus's will to take over her will, and thereby she becomes an instrument of the will of Jesus, and Teresa's will is out the window. So that may sound strange, but that's exactly the process that Jesus himself went through in the Garden of Gethsemane. For example, when he said, you know, Father, if it's possible, take this cup from my lips. But then he immediately says, but not as I would have it, but as thou wilt.
So it's a release of ego.
And part of the reason this is important is particularly in challenging situations where one is in a conflict situation, sometimes one is asked from within to do something that's not directly in one's personal interest. It was not in Jesus' personal interest to go through what was coming after the garden. Martin Luther King talks about this too in that movie Selma that you may have seen. At one point he acknowledges, you know, my personal interest, yes, I would like to live a long life.
Yeah, I may not get there with you.
That's right. My focus can't be right now on my personal interest. There is an impulse within me to do something that takes courage, and I have to take a stand, and I have to recognize it could be harmful. There are times when we have to take those risks. That, I think, is what is meant by this. Not that you become some kind of disempowered functionary in some kingdom and you've lost your true authority. Not at all. You've actually emptied yourself of yourself and then become an instrument for a larger power and wisdom to move through you. And I think that's the meaning of this.
We're talking with Will Keepin. He's the author of Belonging to God. I know, you know, relatives of mine and others who kind of shortcut their explanation of their fears over religious violence simply by compartmentalizing their explanation that terrorists that are threatening and performing violent acts just come from a small, misguided, fractured group of a faith tradition. And I think they say, what can we do but be at war with them, kill them before they kill other innocents or kill us in some random violent act? So what other options related to your area of study might offer frightened citizens or diplomats a path?
Well, what I would like to say is that, first of all, we need to recognize that the tainting of Islam as a religion of evil is basically a kind of propaganda that is very similar to what happened with Judaism in Germany in the 1930s. You know, Judaism was part of the fabric of German society up until through the 20s, and it is again now. But it had this period where it was identified as the evil within and then completely demonized.
Oh, demonized.
And this is very easy to do, particularly with a religion that one knows nothing about. And Americans and Westerners know very little about Islam. So it's easy to pick out a problematic verse from the scripture and then put it together with some heinous acts and then dismiss the entire religion as evil. One could do the same with Christianity, for example. One could choose a couple, especially with a population that knew nothing about Christianity, you could pick a couple verses from Jesus' sayings. One of them, he says at one point, I come not to bring peace, but a sword, you know, to set father at conflict with son and mother with daughter. So he's bringing this sword. And then you would look at, you know, the Crusades and the Holocaust, which was perpetrated by Christian nations, and perhaps apartheid, which was justified by Christianity. So you can look at some of these things and say, well, clearly it is a religion of evil. Jesus said he was bringing a sword, and look how it's been manifest in Christian religions. And then stop there, and your case is closed. But, of course, we know, you and I know, that it's far more profound than that, far more detailed than that. And even the meaning of that verse gets twisted. So that can be done with any scripture and any people. The scripture can be text twisted really to justify any position. So the first thing I want to help people understand is that in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, this Islamophobia has emerged. And Islam has been targeted as sort of seemingly the enemy of the West in some way. But I think this is largely created by political and economic forces. And then the religion has become a kind of a battlefield that is co-opted. That's my personal feeling. I mean, it'd be similar to, for example, science. You could also show that science is evil if you, for example, simply said that, you know, physics gave us nuclear weapons, chemistry gave us, you know, the gas chamber. Biology gave us anthrax and germ warfare. Therefore, science is evil. It's that shallow, I think, the current discourse. We have to look at the full picture because clearly science has given profound gifts. And so I don't really have an answer to the current thing and situation with ISIS. I'm not politically informed or sophisticated enough to know exactly what's going on. The one thing I do feel is that if we allow ourselves to be persuaded by the anti-Islamic rhetoric, then we're falling inadvertently and unwittingly right into ISIS's hands, because it is a small handful of Muslims, and they can't do that much unless they leverage their hatred. And by engaging millions into believing some of this is anti-Islamic rhetoric, if we start to believe that rather than really look into the truth about this religion, then we are actually inadvertently an instrument for their campaign, because ISIS also hates ordinary Muslims. They're very much against ordinary Muslims, loving, peace-loving Muslims, because they don't share their agenda. And they regard such Muslims as apostates, as basically traitors. And so it's very important for us to recognize that we must not allow ourselves to play into that game and become inadvertent, supporters of ISIS's agenda by buying into this anti-Islamic propaganda, anti-Muslim propaganda. I feel that the religions, when you look at them across the board, then there's a message that really stands out. One of my mentors, Father Thomas Keating, who's a Catholic priest, and he's been a very important inspiration for me, and he speaks about the true purpose of Christianity, and he says the entire purpose of Christianity is transformation into Christ, nothing else. This is really the core of the tradition, as St. Paul says at the end, at one point where he says, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. So the whole point is that this consciousness, this Christ consciousness, is to be reborn in us today. That's the really good news. And if we extend that to other religions, the entire purpose of, let's say, Vaishnavite Hinduism is transformation into Krishna, nothing else. The entire purpose of Buddhism is transformation into Buddha, nothing else. You and I and all of our listeners and every human being on earth is called to enter into this profound transformation and become a living Buddha, a living Christ, a living Krishna on the earth now. That is a calling from the soul, from God to the soul, that each of us can answer. And to me, that is the really beauty of the religions. And part of the reason I wrote this book is that we don't lose that beautiful baby with the bathwater when we throw out the dogmas and some of the institutional oppressions of the traditions. The second thing that I would try to help people understand is somewhat of the extent to which the West has imposed its values on other cultures. And this has created a lot of pressure and pushback, really, from many nations across the globe. And so part of what our role is now is to learn how to be a nation among nations rather than a nation that is essentially trying to rule the world culturally. And I think that's an important place that we are still in the process of learning.
And then to someone who doesn't want to choose or may not even want to dig deep into the knowledge of the religions, but say, well, I'm just living by the golden rule, and that's going to guide me. Is your point that if they're saying that, that they're really living by the common themes in multiple religions, and they're okay there?
I think that if one really lives by that rule, yes, they're okay there. I think the whole movement now of spiritual but not religious is a conscious rejection of some of the repression and some of the outdated institutionalizations of the religious institutions, outdated dogmas, outdated practices, for example, prejudices against alternative lifestyles, gay, lesbian lifestyles, oppression of women, some of these patriarchal conditions that have afflicted the religions. So for that reason, many people are sort of dispensing with religion. What's crucial is to go into the depths of one's own heart, learn to listen there deeply, and to follow that guidance. As Shakespeare said so beautifully, above all, be true to thine own self. And then in that connection with that, what would be called the Holy Spirit in Christianity, or the Shakti in Hinduism, this subtle voice that speaks without words, as Rumi puts it, but that will speak if you quiet yourself enough and listen. You will actually hear the voice of the eternal speaking within the depths of yourself, and that will lead you and guide you. And I think that is as legitimate a spiritual path as any. The problem is that the ego can easily come and pose that voice And this is where the traditions have developed methods and mentoring systems to help guide people and help them keep on the path and not go astray. But in essence, what you're saying is true. Living by the golden rule, living by the idea that we should love our neighbor as ourselves, that is such a profound teaching. And that's essentially what the Golden Rule is speaking to.
After a break, we'll have a little bit more with Will Keepin, author of the book Belonging to God, Science, Spirituality, and the Universal Path of Divine Love. He'll have more to say about the common themes in diverse religious traditions. And later, a man who says his art is meant to inspire thoughts of peace and tranquility, and who also established a Peace Prize to honor the work of other peacemakers. That's all when Peace Talks Radio continues in a moment. This is Peace Talks Radio, the nonpartisan series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. You can explore our entire archive of shows going back to 2002 at our website, peacetalksradio.com. You can also subscribe to our podcast from iTunes. I'm Paul Ingalls, and today we're speaking to authors of recent books that caught our attention. Suzanne Kreider will be visiting with artist and author Paul Ray shortly. But first, let me complete my conversation with religious scholar Will Keepin, who's shared with me some ideas that you can read more about in his 2016 book called Belonging to God, Science, Spirituality, and a Universal Path of Divine Love.
I grew up in a Catholic tradition, disconnected from that while in college, probably held on to and prayed to a Lord God for another 10 years, but eventually landed in what's probably more accurately described as a bit of an agnostic camp. Seems like any concept of creation and universal force or God is plausible to me, but knowing firmly that anyone could be right seems a bit futile. So then I guess I focus on trying to live from the heart space that seems supported by most religions. And I think, you know, when you fill out those guides on the internet that say spiritual but not religious, that a lot of people listening fall into those camps, I think. So speak to the agnostic in me or in our audience or even the atheist to suggest, you know, what's the point of this deep study of how religious texts describe their God and humans' ideal relation to God?
Well, thank you for that question. I think it's true. There's been a lot of critique of religion and in the last 10, 15 years. And there's a new atheism that's arising that's rooted in science. And part of the reason I wrote this book is because I feel like that's a false association. There's nothing scientific about atheism, particularly. As I see it, science and spirituality address completely different domains. Science addresses the world of matter and energy and their interaction in the physical universe, and spirituality addresses the more intangible questions of life of who are we, why are we here, where are we headed, what's our purpose. And part of the reason I wrote this book was because I see a grand synthesis of science and spirituality trying to emerge. What I would say about the atheist question is that I was also trained as a scientist, and so with that came an automatic atheism. It's kind of in the curriculum without one's being made explicit. Let's put it that way. It's not made explicit. And so my spiritual journey then evolved on my own inwardly. And then I found that I needed to understand what is it that the religions are really trying to teach and what is it they have in common. And what I came to was a very remarkable parallel between Einstein's relativity theory and the universal path of love across the religions. About 100 years ago, there was this major revolution in physics. One branch of it was the relativity theory, in which Einstein basically developed his theory based on two postulates. One is that the laws of physics should be the same in all frames of reference, so they shouldn't vary depending on where you are or how fast you're moving, basically. Mm-hmm. And the second one was that the speed of light is the same in all frames of reference. The speed of light is universal. And out of that came his whole revolutionary idea of relativity theory, and this showed that space and time are not absolutes. So what seemingly are unchanging eternal absolutes, such as time and its rate of passage, and space, which we think of as sort of empty and permanent and unchanging, turn out that that's not the case. They are not as it appears. And so I applied this same idea to religions with the borrowing those two postulates and saying that the laws of spirituality should be the same in all religions. What's ultimately spiritually true should hold true in different religions. Mm. And secondly, that light, in this case divine light, whatever that spiritual light is, should have the function the same way in different religions. And it turns out if you explore the scriptures and the mystics of the different traditions, indeed that appears to be the case, that the process of the light, Jesus, for example, in the Christian tradition, he said, "I am the light of the world." But he also said, "You are the light of the world." And the whole spiritual journey in the Christian context is that transformation of the individual soul from being a separate, separated egoic self to actually becoming a living part of the divine light that Jesus was. And so in that same way, we see a similar transformation in the other religions where the human being becomes an instrument for the divine light. They use different metaphors in different religions, but that process of being transformed from essentially human darkness into an instrument of divine light is there across all the traditions. When I saw that, I thought this closely parallels what Einstein was speaking about. And it seemed to me then that there could be a similar kind of awakening within spirituality, that there is a universality across the religions. That is the whole point of religions in the first place, this transformation of the human kind of unconsciousness into a being of conscious light, and that that is the same across the different religions. That was very inspiring to me, and it kind of led me to begin really contemplating how science could shed light on this universal truth across the religions.
Mm-hmm. You do talk about science. And toward the end of the book, you write that scientists live entirely within their minds. Do you think that that's totally true?
Well, I said most scientists.
Okay.
And I think it's changing now, but very slowly. I think that science has traditionally understood its work as twofold. One is empirical observations of physical data, and then theoretical conceptualizations of that data to explain it. And that is mostly a mental exercise, although often quite brilliant and quite inspired. But what I was speaking about there is that the process of spiritual transformation entails a consciousness that takes us beyond the mind. It mm-hmm. takes us not only into the other dimensions of human experience, such as, to some extent, the emotional and the physical, but it also takes us into the spiritual dimension of human consciousness, which is a kind of higher, more refined level of consciousness that is spoken about, again, across the religious traditions. We find particularly the mystics in the different traditions speaking of transcendent levels of awareness and consciousness. And the way they speak about it is very similar across the traditions. This is another reason I was inspired to write the book. So in one of my middle chapters, for example, I take some of the greatest mystics in the Christian and the Islamic and the Hindu traditions and show that their insights of this transcendent dimension of consciousness are very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, what I'm saying is very few scientists have probed that level of awareness because it's not recognized yet in science as even a valid part of scientific inquiry.
Would you agree that someone like the Dalai Lama is a hopeful bridge between the two? Because I think many point to him as being a real student of science, and one would certainly have to say he's not entirely in the mind.
Yes, I think the Dalai Lama is a bridge coming from the religious side. He's primarily, as he loves to say himself, a simple monk, although he's being very humble in that statement, clearly. But he is very much a student of science, and he has really worked hard to look for the areas of common ground. And he's even said that if science finds certain truths in Buddhism that turn out to be mistaken, we will change it, because Buddhism is a living tradition that is self-correcting. At the same time, what's now beginning to happen is some scientists are beginning to really delve deeply into some of the spiritual practices and beginning to awaken to these new dimensions of themselves.
You can hear quite a bit more our complete conversation with religious scholar and author Will Keepin at our website, peacetalksradio.com. You'll also find a link there to his 2016 book, Belonging to God, Science, Spirituality, and a Universal Path of Divine Love. Next, though, an artist and author called Paul Ray. Paul Ray's best known for his book, The Dance of the Pencil, Serene Art by Paul Ray. Also for his traveling exhibit of touchable art for the blind and sighted. And for the Paul Bartlett Ray Peace Prize, administered by the University of New Mexico Foundation. And full disclosure here, Peace Talks Radio's twice been awarded the Paul Ray Peace Prize. Now, there was no quid pro quo in us inviting him on the show now. We just wanted to learn more about him, his devotion to peace, and his 2016 book, Art, Peace, and Transcendence, Rayograms That Elevate and Unite. You can follow a link from our website, peacetalksradio.com, to see examples of Paul Ray's hand and hand-to-digital swooping and flowing art. Suzanne Kreider interviewed Paul Ray in 2017, and he told her of becoming interested in peace philosophy when back in high school he was preparing a paper on the early transcendentalists.
The American philosophical movement in New England, the 19th century, and probably Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson are the two best-known exponents of that. And they believed that there was a universal spirit which pervaded everything, all human beings, all of nature, everything in existence, and that an individual could tap into the wisdom and insight of that directly without needing an intermediary. And that very much moved me, and particularly Emerson's words, the soul's highest duty is to be of good cheer. And so then I went to Caltech in college, and in 72 I graduated with a degree in physics, and I was very deeply moved by the beauty of physics and science in general and mathematics, but I was also very deeply disturbed that science had made possible, for example, weapons of mass destruction and other armaments in war. And I was also very sad that technology was being employed by consumerism to dismantle nature, our life support system, and that which gives us so much beauty and inspiration. And so instead of going to graduate school in science, as would have been expected, I became an artist. But I continued, actually, with the science by doing research into form and shape. It was a geometrical study, and I presented the results as artworks, and I used those artworks to advocate for a science and technology that was wisdom-guided, that put humanitarian and environmental values at the fore. And I also used my artwork to try and promote healing and understanding in the world. And that has been the focus, the core intent of my artwork these many years, these last 4.5 decades.
Talk about the kinds of art you do and what they have to do with peace.
My works first are all derived from closed curves, and these closed curves represent the interconnectedness of everything in creation, from the scale of the complete universe down to the subatomic. And they symbolize the peaceful interaction of human beings, the interconnectedness of everything in ecology. And those closed curves are just telling us that everything in existence is so entwined. And when we do something here in our own space, it affects everything else, and vice versa. So that intertwining of everything, that feeling connected to all of nature and all of the universe, is what my artwork is symbolizing. It's like a mantra, a visual mantra, or a mandala, which is sort of a visualization of the whole universe and used as an aid in meditation. So there are many people who do use my artworks as visual mantras. Many people start their day studying the artworks, their very subtle symmetries and the soothing qualities of them, and they use them as the basis for their morning meditation. I've had some very, very moving letters from people, different states, different countries, and it feels very, very good to me. And so when I do my own meditation, I'm sending out good thoughts to everyone else. So it is just this feeling of great interconnectedness to everything. And in fact, scientifically, there's much foundation for that, since the whole universe emerged from the Big Bang. If you do astronomical observations, we find that galaxies are moving away from us. And the further away that they are from us, the faster they're moving. And if you reverse that in time, you come to the conclusion that the whole universe emerged from a point singularity. Mm. And that should be something that everyone can just remember. You know, we all came from the single point. That's an incredibly beautiful scientific and mathematical thing. It's also a very spiritual thing. And so when people are behaving in ways that we would say were not ideal, if we can remember they too came from the Big Bang and we're all children of the Big Bang, that unites us all, that helps us all to try and get along. And there's just this beautiful, beautiful interconnectedness of everything. And if we could just focus on that great beauty and that great harmony, that life could be the joyful experience that spirit really wants us to have.
When I looked at your book, there were prints in art, peace, and transcendence that made me think of two things. One was they often looked to me like it was inside the body, almost like inside of a vein or an artery or a body. But the other thing was they seemed very erotic.
Well, I don't know what to say to that, except...
I thought you were going to say, well, people see whatever they are or whatever.
I would say because they go back to the Big Bang, and the Big Bang, because that was the original conception of everything in this universe. I mean, you might, I suppose, think that was an erotic thing, but it's geometry. It's just very beautiful, flowing grace. Whatever one sees in it, you know, if that moves them, that's fine.
I thought you might say that. Okay, there's a quote in your book, Art, Peace, and Transcendence. I'd like you to explain. It goes like this. When we thoroughly integrate peace into all our thoughts and actions. Our lives become works of art.
Yes, the art is not just something you do on paper or on a canvas. Art is everything we do in life. When we do it with grace, when we do it with harmony, when we do it with a feeling of kindness and forgiveness if necessary, whatever is required by the situation.
Basically, does that mean like this interview can be a work of art?
Oh, yes, certainly. Absolutely everything.
Oh.
Everything we do is a work of art. Yes, 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 everything we do. Even the things that seem like terrible chores, if we can see them as an opportunity to communicate with the universe and to really enjoy it, because we're supposed to enjoy everything. Mm. We really are. And I keep going back to that feeling I had as a very young child, just that feeling of joy. And like when I'm walking down the sidewalk, my feet almost don't reach the ground. And yet I've been through my share of trials and tribulations, certainly. But still, I know that it's that joy that really endures. That is what life is really all about, what we're all seeking, something we can really live for, that we can be part of, that we can feel that we are creating with it.
If I flipped this quote and said we don't thoroughly integrate peace into our thoughts and actions, our lives do not become works of art. How have you seen that to be true?
Well, unfortunately, I have seen it quite often. Mm. I think when people are forgetting their connection to the infinite, I think the whole problem in life comes from forgetfulness, really. We need to remember who we are. We're children of the Big Bang. We're children of spirit. And if that's true, then how should we behave? And if it's also true, it means that we have all of that spirit behind us, helping us, and we can draw on it. And it will flow through us. Joy is a river that wants to flow through us, is one of my poems. And I think that's what I would really love to communicate with my work, that there's just so much joy and light in it. And I want people to feel this, and I want people to be happy and at peace, and life wants people to enjoy life. That's what we're here for. We're supposed to enjoy it. And so let's do it.
We'll have more ahead after a break from Suzanne Kreider's conversation with artist, author, poet, and peace proponent Paul Ray in just a moment. I'm Paul Ingalls, producer of Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Thanks for listening. You can find more information, pictures, videos, our entire audio archive, and more good stuff at our website, peacetalksradio.com. But right now, we continue our visit with artist, author, poet, and peace proponent Paul Ray. Here again is Suzanne Kreider.
Paul Ray, you've made touchable art for people who are not sighted. So what is your connection to people who are blind?
Okay, another little story from when I was young. I think I was 6 or 7. I went barefoot a lot, and I would blindfold myself, and I would walk around the house, and just from what my feet were touching, figure out where I was. And then I would go outside, and I would walk all around outside, blindfolded. And it was really quite an experience. I can tell you about it, but you really have to experience it. I mean, try it. Try it. It's really quite fun. Mm. And just see what you can figure out about the world just through your feet. And I had read right around that time Helen Keller's book. I think it was called The World I Live In. It had moved me very greatly. And in doing that little experiment, I thought, well, you know, maybe someday I'll work with the blind in some way. Hmm. And so it turns out in about 1980, I was looking at a sheet of basic shapes from an article I'd written for Leonardo, which is an international archival art journal which bridges art, science, and technology. And that sheet of basic shapes showed the internal contours of 60 drawings and paintings of mine, all derived from closed curves. And I had the feeling that those line drawings could be translated into embossings that would be meaningful to the blind. So I then set about figuring out how to do that technically, ended up doing it in pressure thermoforming on a mold that I had made partly out of masonite and wires of various thicknesses and various other materials to give textures. Then I sent it around to various blind persons around the country and found quite a number of quite excellent testers, and particularly right here in New Mexico. And they gave me some very good feedback, and I felt that indeed there was a call for this. There would be a place for it. So I made a traveling exhibit of these, and the first showing of it was actually at Caltech. And then that has been all around the country and in the Canada 18 times, and it was very, very moving, the response that I received from both blind and sighted, because we would have sighted persons be blindfolded and then go and feel it and then come back and try and draw the works. And we also did that with blind persons, and it was a great learning exercise. I did many different kinds of workshops with it. Really a fascinating adventure in my own life. And because the blind have so much to offer us, this is such a scattering world. And if you have to get by in this world without being able to see, you can imagine what it's like and the focus that it takes. So we can learn much from the blind. The sighted can help the blind, and everyone works together, and it's really a very, very beautiful bridging between the blind and sighted.
Mm. Paul Ray, read your poem, Bridging to Peace.
Very good. Bridging to Peace. My life has been a journey of bridging art and science, east and west, the worlds of the blind and sighted, humankind with nature, and most basically, a bridging to the serenity deep within me. Continuing this journey, may my art help others to nurture their tranquil center, and may they then build bridges spreading outward from their inner harmony to a global peace.
Does everybody have a tranquil center?
Yes, I believe everyone does, although many are very, very obscured and covered up. I believe it's there within everyone. but we have to remove the baggage of our lives and ages and all the bad habits and so forth. And in doing that, it reveals that center which is in everyone and which connects us all, let's say, back to the Big Bang. It's there in everyone. And some people may have a lot more challenge in finding it, but it is there. And I think affirming it for ourselves and affirming it for others is a very positive and growth-affirming way of approaching life.
It's so interesting to talk to you because someone must have bummed you out. So I want to hear a story of how you've used your peacefulness to deal with someone who bummed you out.
Well, I nearly died, actually. That's a little more than that.
That's a lot.
Yes, actually, my first years as an artist were extremely challenging. I had no connections in the art world at all, no formal training, but I began showing off fairly soon after I began, and my works were critically acclaimed by places such as San Francisco Chronicle, Art West, and Art Week, and they were very much appreciated, and they were shown in some very prominent galleries like Gump's Art Gallery, who behaved very honorably towards me, really, but there were other galleries who did not, and to make a long story short, let's just say I had some very cold and hungry years. Mm. And I was actually at one point not expected to live long. What I experienced then helped me to have compassion for those who are suffering. The one art dealer I had nearly starved me to death.
Mm.
And in living through that, it takes a great deal of forgiveness. And yet I also recognized there was a lot of good in this person. And yet to almost die from the experience, it means that you really have to believe in what you're saying, that everything is all connected, that we are to experience joy in this life, and yet we might die along the way. It's not the end of the story, because light is the only thing that can really be the end of the story, the triumph of light over darkness. And I think experiencing that, maybe there's no substitute for it. Maybe you just have to go through it to really know it. And then once you've done it and can then really feel that forgiveness, and then that great beauty that there is in life, then one can maybe really help others who are in great difficulties.
And forgiveness is really hard. Tell our listeners, if you made a piece of art about forgiveness, what would it look like?
I have not explicitly done a single work called Forgiveness. But I think the closed curves of all of my works contain a little bit of that in all of them. And I think that by having that time release aspect of forgiveness in our lives, shall we say, so if we don't need to do it all at once, if we just need to do a little bit each step of the way, that then it becomes very natural. And we don't even think of it as forgiveness. That's when it's really forgiveness. That's when it really works, when we no longer have to call it forgiveness.
What do we think of it as?
Joy.
Ow. Joy. Paul, tell us, do you have any works in progress?
Yes, a great many works. Besides the Rheograms, a continuation of those, my book covers Rheograms, which are a hybrid hand digital work. They make use of the works which I had done by hand in previous years, and then digitally I play with them. So they themselves are a beautiful example of bridging, in a sense, between left and right. And so many more Rheograms, many more poems, many more puns. And in fact, my next book is called The Rhe, as in my name. My name is spelled just two letters, R-E, with a written accent over the E, so it's Rhe Cycled Dictionary. Mm. And subtitle, Aphorisms, Puns, and Micro-Essays to Promote Peace. So this is a sequel to Art, Peace, and Transcendence. And by the way, the subtitle of that book was Rheograms That Elevate and Unite. And so in this new book, this dictionary book, which I've been working on very, very intently for 8 months now, it is a compilation of almost 55 volumes that I've written in the past 45 years, of about more than 50,000 aphorisms and puns, little micro essays, which are not only fun, shall we say, wordplay, but also have much substance and try to point out just much insight about life. And so I think that joy and that levity that I felt when I came into this world, that's what I want to leave behind when I leave. And so, for example, let's see, peace workers, ones who transform harm into harmony. This one might be appropriate for the particular period of history we're now in. Challenging times. Let us make it through in one, W-O-N, peace, P-E-A-C-E. Let us make it through in one peace.
That's perfect.
Alrighty.
You can head to our website, peacetalksradio.com, for so much more. A link to our longer conversation with Paul Rhe about his artwork and philosophies and his latest book, Art, Peace, and Transcendence. Also, you can hear more from our earlier guest, author and religious scholar Will Keepin. All at our website, peacetalksradio.com. It's where you can hear every show in the Peace Talks Radio series going back to 2002. Also, you can find links to more details and research on each episode. Photos, audio downloads, there's a link to iTunes to subscribe to our podcast. You can sign up for a monthly newsletter there, and it's also where you can make a tax-deductible contribution to the nonprofit media organization Good Radio Shows Incorporated that produces Peace Talks Radio separate and apart from your public radio station. So that's peacetalksradio.com to help. Support also comes from the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, KUNM at the University of New Mexico, and a Spinal Health and Movement Center and Ruben Ramirez in Albuquerque's Knob Hill neighborhood. Nola Daves Moses is our executive director. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For Suzanne Kreider, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks so much for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.